This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Well, a lot isn't happening. It wouldn't seem that way, but looking at all the stories I happen to see from Times State House reporter Dan Carton, it's been a pretty busy place at the Indiana General Assembly here in the last few weeks or so since we've last talked. And we have Dan back on the show to talk about what's coming up here and the stories he's put out there online and in print in the Times. And as always, Dan, thank you for spending time with us.
Happy to be here.
Well, I've got this big sheaf of stories here to go through. Let's kind of go down the list. Let's start out here with the story that you had out recently. It seems to have gotten an awful lot of attention here, at least maybe by the wrong people, we don't know, about what the BMV is doing to keep up with the standards that they have to follow as being an official Bureau of Motor Vehicles. And with all the others in the country, they made some changes that apparently some folks are not happy about. Tell us about that.
It's really turning into quite the kerfuffle down here at the State House. So earlier this month, the Bureau of Motor Vehicles started allowing people to get a driver's license or state ID card with the letter X as their gender instead of M or F or male or female. They are doing this following sort of a national organization that... sort of a trade group for BMVs all over the country that recommended states start allowing this to recognize that there are people who don't identify as either male or female and still need some type of valid identification, and they appreciate having an identification that reflects their identity. So the BMV went ahead and made this change. The BMV is an agency overseen by Governor Eric Holcomb, who is a Republican, so presumably he supports the change. But pretty quickly, a lot of Republicans in the General Assembly pushed back against the change. There initially was an amendment filed to a separate bill moving through the House that would have prohibited the BMV from using the X gender identifier. That was not called for a vote, in part because the next day there was a amendment put on a measure sponsored by State Senator Eddie Melton of Gary that a House committee added to his bill that would basically make it more difficult for any trans person or non-binary person to either change their gender from male to female or vice versa, or to get the X identifier by requiring, instead of an official doctor's note, that a person get a court order and have their birth certificate officially changed at the State Department of Health, and then take that amended birth certificate to the BMV to change the gender on their driver's license. So even though we have a Republican governor who let this policy go into force, there's Republicans in the General Assembly who don't share his views on gender identity issues, and they're pushing back, and they seem to have the power to get it done.
Now, do you think that this is probably kind of an unanswered question to what we may face, because the question hasn't come up yet, as to what the hate crimes bill is going to be all about? We know what the Republican-led House and Senate have to say about that, and what Governor Holcomb has to say about that. Mm-hmm. And do you think that maybe this is just one little niche in the whole thing that will come up when the debate finally comes up as to whether a hate crimes bill will pass this session?
Yeah, it's definitely a corollary. Right before coming on the phone with you, I was at the with House Speaker Brian Bosma doing his weekly availability with State House reporters, and he said that this driver's license issue has, basically said, distracted House Republicans from focusing on this bias crime question, and that they were so concerned with taking care of this driver's license thing that they haven't really been paying attention to bias crimes in the way that the governor wants them to, which is to pass a comprehensive measure that includes a list of protected classes, including gender identity and sexual orientation. And Speaker Bosma said that it's possible that some people's minds were changed to now oppose the bias crimes measure based on what the governor did through the BMV with the driver's license thing. So it's that the pot is being stirred, if you will, and who knows what's going to come out in the end.
Well, do you think that this is turned out to be one of the magician's best tools, misdirection?
Possibly. I mean, it would be an interesting strategy for the governor to take. He did say he was going to do everything he could to get this bias crime measure through the General Assembly, but he seems to have angered members of his own party by doing this. So I'm not sure if that's going to work out so well for him.
Yeah, it would appear that way. You're right. You're right. One of the other stories, too, that you've also added here, too, is an update here that came about, I guess, actually it was an Indiana Supreme Court ruling that came out that involves the city of Hammond and the annual rental property registration fees and how it's the city of Hammond is apparently changing compared to a couple other college towns. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's another one of those unintended consequences kind of thing. A few years back, the General Assembly sought to limit rental registration fees. Several Northwest Indiana communities had imposed these fees. Some of them were as high as $80, $100 a year on rental properties per unit. So it was raising a substantial amount of money for these communities that had lost a lot of money through the tax caps. So the General Assembly put in a fee restriction that said no municipality could charge more than $5 a year, but it also exempted out West Lafayette and Bloomington because the General Assembly said those were college communities that I guess kids are used to getting ripped off and paying too much for stuff in college. So go ahead and keep imposing your fees. But the way they exempted those two communities also allowed Hammond to claim that they were exempted from the fee restriction. So Hammond tried to continue collecting its $80 a year fee. A landlord in Hammond sued. We got this lawsuit, and ultimately what the Supreme Court decided was that the exemptions for West Lafayette and Bloomington and Hammond, which never really went into effect in Hammond, were all unconstitutional special legislation. And everybody in every community in the state is subject to the $5 fee restriction. So Hammond trying to get its exemption ended up costing Bloomington and West Lafayette a considerable amount of money that they were getting off these rental registration fees.
I don't know about Bloomington, but I know the folks in West Lafayette are probably screaming about this. And all you have to do is to go into the village in West Lafayette near the Purdue main campus and see all of the high-rises going up all around the area to show with more apartments and everything that people are moving into in West Lafayette. I can see the fees would probably be helpful to the landlords.
Yeah, and the cities use this money to ensure that the properties are safe, mm-hmm. which especially in a place in a college town where the units are turning over every single year, you'd want to get somebody in there to make sure they're just not, taking a trashed unit from last year's students and giving it to this year's students.
One of the other stories, too, that you had in the Times in print and online follows up, at least we found, too, and had our conversation with Ingrid Norris, who's the executive director of the Lake County Public Library, is this bill that they have lobbied very hard against and other library directors all across the state, this measure that would affect them financially very hard. Tell us what the latest is on that.
Yeah, so where it stood last week was that basically the measure is not moving through the committee the way that it is now. The legislation would basically give municipalities or counties, whichever organizes the library system, the right to control the budget.
Mm-hmm.
There's a philosophical idea at the General Assembly that's been implemented over quite a few years now that only elected officials should decide how money is, or how decide about taxes and tax levies and tax rates. And they think that library boards aren't most, since no library boards are elected, that some elected officials should have some oversight over what those library boards are doing. So this would give the option for the cities or the counties that run the libraries to decide on how much money the library is able to raise through property taxes each year, and correspondingly how the library spends it. Libraries think this is just an invitation for the county or the city to steal all their money and use it for something else, and they put up quite a resistance. That resonated with the Senate Local Government Committee. I was in that committee this morning for a different bill, And the library measure has not come back yet, and we are getting close toward the second half committee deadline. So it's not clear whether or not that one is going to go anywhere. So it may be, the librarians may have succeeded in killing it for the year.
Well, we know that a couple from here in Northwest Indiana, in particular, the library director in Hammond, as well as Ingrid Norris, were down there at that hearing in Indianapolis, doing their part to lobby against it. And so, you know, you say they must have made a very persuasive argument and made people think, well, maybe that's not the way we should take this right now.
Yeah, a lot of the members of the committee seemed to recognize that this grew out of a single library district in one state senator's hometown, and I think they're thinking that maybe we don't need a state law to fix something that probably should be fixed locally.
Mm-hmm. One of the other stories, too, Dan, that you had out there for us to take a look at from the General Assembly was action that the Indiana House took here involving, I guess, another controversial issue that has been controversial for so long that maybe it hasn't been has become rather non-controversial. That's the question about medical care for women based on ethical, moral, or religious objections to abortion. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's already a provision in state law that exempts physicians, hospital employees, and medical clinic employees from having to participate in an abortion or service, you know, provide an abortion if they object to it for any particular reason. This legislation would add nurses, physician assistants, and pharmacists to that statute, allowing them to opt out. Supporters of the measure said it's a reasonable conscience protection because nobody should be forced to participate in an abortion if they object to the procedure, regardless of what their job is. Critics pointed out that, particularly for the pharmacist, there's several drugs that can be used to induce an abortion, but also are often prescribed to, for example, complete a miscarriage. So you could get women who have miscarried, who aren't no longer pregnant with a live child, and they come into a pharmacy with a prescription, and the pharmacist would reject it, regardless of what the woman and her doctor say the woman needs to complete this miscarriage, because the pharmacist thinks it's a prelude to an abortion. And that was really the focus of the discussion, this sort of who should be making the decision.
Right.
If you have a job as a medical professional, should you serve everybody who comes in the door, or are you allowed to pick and choose based on your personal moral beliefs about the validity of any particular procedure?
Well, in fact, you mentioned one of our Northwest Indiana lawmakers even had some comments about that during the discussion about the impact that it would have if pharmacists had the extra power, I suppose, to be able to deny emergency contraception.
Right. State Representative Chris Chung, a first-term Democrat from Dyer, made the point that rape victims potentially seeking emergency contraception would be denied by a pharmacist. The sponsor of the measure said that it doesn't address contraception. It's only focused on abortion-inducing drugs. But there is a not insignificant group of people in the anti-abortion movement who view birth control pills and especially the morning-after pill as abortion-inducing drugs, because if you believe that life begins at the moment of conception and a drug prevents a fertilized egg from being implanted, then in their point of view, you are actually committing an abortion because there is life there from the moment of conception. So it can be pretty controversial.
And we'll see. That's still got to go through the Senate. We'll find out what the latest is on that as it moves along, too. Dan, we just have a few minutes left here. Let's focus our time left on one other measure that comes up occasionally. It has before about how the state superintendent of public instruction is employed and who employs that person and how we're going to see some changes here. And there may be a vote coming in the Senate about that pretty soon.
The Senate has already voted on it on Tuesday. They voted 29-19. To eliminate the elected state superintendent of public instruction, who runs the Indiana Department of Education, oversees $6 billion in spending that gets sent out to local schools. Hoosiers have been electing this person since the mid-19th century, but never going to get to vote for state superintendent again. This legislation gives the choice of the head of the Department of Education to the governor. The position is going to be called the Secretary of Education. It's going to be a governor-appointed position. There are a few qualifications in the bill, but not any requirement that the person be a classroom teacher or have any experience in the classroom. You could, you know, be the manager of a charter school or an education lobbying company and be appointed. So it's really a pretty significant transformation in education in the state, because we have always had an elected governor and a separately elected state superintendent, and sometimes they've clashed, as we saw with Mike Pence and Glenda Ritz. Sometimes they've gotten along, like with Mitch Daniels and Tony Bennett. But now it's all going to be the governor. The governor is going to be in charge of the Department of Education, and when people vote for governor in 2020, they're not just picking the governor, they're picking the person who's going to run the entire, you know, education apparatus of the state of Indiana.
Now, as you can recall now, how many other states are going to be in that situation that Indiana's now joining?
Yeah, it's actually most states. Indiana's kind of weird in that it elected its state superintendent. For example, in Illinois, the State Board of Education picks the state superintendent. Mm-hmm. But other states also have elected state school boards, and Indiana still has an appointed state school board. So you're going to have the governor appointing the state school board, the governor appointing the state superintendent, and the state school board has its own staff, the Department of Education has its own staff. So we have all these, we're going to have all these governor-appointed education people duplicating a lot of their work that sometimes made sense when the state superintendent was running a separate agency. But if everybody's governor-appointed, why do we have all these duplicate people? I guess that's something for the legislature to figure out in 2021 when this goes into effect.
Well, the legislature is not done. In fact, we haven't even gotten to anything about the budget. If there's going to be any really discussion about the budget, that'll come soon. So we hope, Dan, we have you back on to talk about that and some other stories again real soon.
Anytime.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Times State House reporter Dan Carton, and you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. No matter where you live in the country, many people have an opinion about the proposed border wall. But how do the people in the southern part of Texas feel about it? Well, while on vacation, Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson went to gas stations, recreational halls, even a planetarium in several towns in South Texas, and she got the locals' opinions about the proposed border wall.
In Gulfview Estates, a 55 and over retirement community in Mission, Texas, there's people from all over the United States and Canada who live down there, most of them for only part of the year. They are called winter Texans. Others, a minority amount, live there year-round. Lakeshore Public Radio traveled to the southernmost part of Texas to get their opinions on the barrier wall that would go between Texas and Mexico. We asked John Meadows from Des Moines, Iowa.
What's your opinion on the border wall? Should there be one? Why or why not?
My opinion of the border wall is we can get along without it. We just need a little more people with authority to have a little better knowledge than they got. I know what my good friends are. They watch Fox News, so I got to be careful what I say.
Say whatever you want.
I want to maintain my friendship with them.
All right.
I value their friendship.
And so I then turn to the friend standing next to John Meadows, Jim Jackson, who lives part of the year in Mission and the other part in Oregon, Illinois.
Why don't you give me your opinion of the border wall?
I'm really not thinking about the border wall, but if anything will help, I'm sure. It's expensive, but we give other countries lots of money, so instead of giving it to them, fix our own country first.
Joyce Golden is from Cudahy, Wisconsin, a suburb of Milwaukee. Golden was in Mission visiting family.
You used to be a police officer.
Correct.
A deputy sheriff, Milwaukee County deputy sheriff. So can you give me your opinion of the border wall? Should we have one? Why or why not?
Well, I actually had an opportunity to see it, and I personally think that, yes, it's going to be something that we need. And it seems that the locals are wanting it. It was interesting on a tour boat ride that we took on the Rio Grande that only 2% of the people, like out of every 10 people they arrest, only two are of Mexican descent. The rest are from other countries, China, Honduras, all different other countries. So there's really, I think, a misperception that they're all Mexicans, and it's not. So I think it is something we need, and it's only a part of what we need. There needs to be a bunch of different systems. They have blimps. They have the Border Patrol. They have Border Patrol on horses. They have drones, and all those things together are necessary, because just a wall isn't going to be the cure-all, so to speak. And we had an opportunity to go to a pull ferry. It's the only one left in the United States, and we had the opportunity to talk to a customs when we came, because we went across the river, which is Mexico, so when you came back, you had to show your passport. And so it wasn't busy. We had an opportunity to talk to her, and she's been doing this for 22 years, and she actually claimed we were talking in a light manner about tunnels. And she says, oh, yeah, they have tunnels. She says, even they found one underneath the river already, you know. But those just show that you need multiple ways of border patrol. A wall is not the cure-all, but I think it would be effective in many of the situations. But you still need the horses, you still need the cars patrolling, you need the blimp and the cameras and all that. So, yes, I'm for the wall.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We then turn to Golden's sister, Phyllis McGrory, from Waterford, Wisconsin.
I know it's a very divided subject. I'm having friends at home that think we absolutely, positively have to have that wall, and then other friends that are saying that we don't need to be spending the money on that. Those people are going to find a way to get in here with a wall or without a wall. There's a lot of sadness here about the wall because it's dividing a national park that houses birds and butterflies, and there's a church that it's involving and other businesses in another park. So a lot of people around the country don't realize that. So it is a very divided subject.
What was the name of the park?
Benson National Park. I'm not sure if that's the correct total name, but it's Benson National Park. And then there is the Butterfly Park. And then I think Benson Park is the one that has the birding. People come from all over the world to do the birding and the butterflying. So it's going to take a lot of property away from both of those.
Can you give me your first and last name? Your first name?
Not really.
No? Okay, well, that's all right.
I'll answer your questions.
Okay, the question is, do we need a border wall, and why or why not, in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, border walls, I honestly don't even have an opinion on that. I don't see really a problem in it, and then I don't see a problem against it.
Okay.
It can be seen as we need one, and it can be seen as we don't need one, but really, in my opinion, I honestly have never looked into it. So, honestly, I can't really give an opinion for that, since I have never really looked into the problems or anything wrong with it. So,
okay. Well, thank you so much.
No problem.
Where are you from?
I'm from Harlingen. I recently moved over here to Alamo, so really not that far.
Nellie Garcia from Palmview, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley, has lived in the area all her life. She said, if anything, the wall will bring people jobs. We got her perspective.
Do you think that there should be a border wall? Why or why not? Do you think one's needed?
My family is directly across this river. My Mexican family is directly across. There is a lot of violence on the other side of our river. Very bad violence going on. But it's a drug fight. It's a territory fight for drugs. But that's on that side of the river. My personal opinion about the wall is, if we build it, there's going to be a lot of jobs. And then a new president will come in and we'll drop it, and there's going to be a lot of jobs. So in my end of it, I don't care for a wall or no wall. It's a lifestyle here. We cross the border. I go to Mexico and I come back. I go to Megalemán. I go to Reynosa. I cross the border very often. But I see it as a job opportunity for a lot of people here, to be honest.
And how long have you lived out here?
My whole life, 37 years.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Whitney Reynolds Show will debut the ninth season opener on Monday, March 25th at 6 p.m. on Lakeshore PBS. And host Whitney Reynolds recently sat down with Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson to talk about the upcoming season.
The Whitney Reynolds Show is dedicated to provoking positive change through tough topics. The mission should really be considered a personal mantra. The show, which began as an online talk show, within its first year quickly earned a slot on a major broadcast network. For the last 7 years, it has called PBS its home. Whitney Reynolds is the executive producer, host, and owner of the show. Whitney, thanks for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
It is such an honor to be with you guys.
First, can you just tell us a little bit about what inspired your vision for the Whitney Reynolds Show?
Yeah, so I've always been good at TV. From a young age, I knew that's what I was going to do. But when I was growing up in a small town in Oklahoma, my family went through a semi-tragic event, and it really shaped me. And it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I was in the career of television that I realized that I wasn't given that as a little kid on accident. It was a very clear vision that I was called to create a show where people know their topics, similar to mine, no matter what it may be, is safe. And we are going to give people hope and inspiration through whatever comes our way.
Now, Monday, March 25th, the Whitney Reynolds Show will premiere its ninth season, which, by the way, is no small feat. Now, how has your show evolved since its early days?
Well, I always say people grew up literally with me. I started this show when I was 23. I stepped into our mission around the age of 26. And with that, it's been kind of climbing the ladder, but in a very public way. And when I say that is, you know, I'm 32 now. I've had babies with my viewers, not literally on TV, but, you know, y'all have grown up with me and you've seen me evolve into this woman and talk show host that I have become. And it's been really special to see, you know, now that we're launching season 9, and this is one of my favorite seasons yet. And I say that because these topics, now that we're in season 9, we have viewers from all over submit ideas and come into Chicagoland to tape these topics, and it's absolutely amazing. So this season is really powerful with just what's going to unfold on our set. And then also, we launched in a new market starting this spring. So now we're in 6 states and 4 markets, so I'm so pumped. I actually have Amy Schumer on the show, and we talk about loving yourself from the inside out and what that really looks like, because so often the world tells us what we should look like or what we should feel about ourselves. And this show is saying, you know what, your self-image really comes from within, and it's a really beautiful way to kick everything off.
What's a better way to kick off the season than to celebrate women with two of the funniest women in show business right now? Now, you said you had Amy Schumer and A.D. Bryant.
Yeah, so they were off for their new movie, and it was interesting because we went with the angle of self-image. There's so many aspects to it. I mean, being a public figure, I get it, because when you put yourself out there, no matter if it's on social media, TV, you're going to get some good feedback, but you're also putting yourself out there where people can say things back to you that might not be so kind. And so with that, we kind of touch on all those points of just self-image. The movie I Feel Pretty was all about that. It's one of those things that she realizes in the movie that she's beautiful all along, and it didn't take any changing. And that's what we really delve into with that interview. On that show, we also have a woman who came over, was adopted from India, had polio, and they had to take her arm muscles and put them in her legs, and now she is a model on a national campus.
Wow,
and
how cool is that?
It is so cool. Yeah, when she was growing up, she would watch commercials and say, why do I not see any girls that look like me on there? And she decided to change it. So this show, self-image, is just like, okay, let's just open it all up with the inspiration and letting people know that they truly are beautiful just the way they are. And sometimes we need that reminder.
Absolutely. Do me a favor and just give me a sneak peek of what else do you have on deck for this season?
So we have a yearly Women Entrepreneur Show, and every year we do a unique twist with it. And this year it's junior entrepreneurs, and there are just so many amazing young women that are on this set that are talking to, you know, kind of the young dreamers and showing people they can do it. We have a vlogger from the South. We have two girls that developed a safe and sound spray is what it's called. And it helps if you're being attacked on a college campus or anywhere, actually, you can spray it. And not only does it sound an alarm, but the dye stays on the person for 48 hours. And I think in this day and age, you know, all the Me Too stuff that's come up for men and women, it's such a great, I mean, this product couldn't have come at a more timely time. And they were 16 when they developed it. And that's what's really cool about that one. And then we have social media impact. And this show was super interesting because we're all kind of growing up in this social media age. But really, we look at the mental component and what it could be doing. And we even hear from a doctor how people are trying to change themselves for social media. And that show, if you have ever questioned where you think we're going or what's going on social media, or ever wondered, like, is it weird that I want to check my status? This is the show to tune into. That one actually comes on April 8th. That's a must watch because it's just super interesting. And we have a lot of experts on to walk us through kind of what's happened in the last 10 years or so when it comes to kind of our need to be online. We have reinventions. And what I love about this show, it really declares that it's not over until it's over. And no matter what stage of life you're in, you can always find your next journey if you look. And on April 29th, we sit down, very, very powerful interview with one woman. We're talking with Angela Rose. And Angela Rose, she is one that I will forever think of whenever I think of people that have taken what cards they were given and has just used them to help others to an extreme level. And Angela Rose was taken by knife point from the mall, and she was sexually assaulted and somehow got away and has now created an organization that is helping victims know that they too can survive this and thrive in life through what she went through. It is a very hard episode, but it's also really important to understand that this is a person that went through something very difficult. And on the other side, it's like, you can be okay. And now you can make this a platform to help others. And she is doing that day in and day out. And it wasn't always pretty. And she let us know that, but there's so much hope in her story. And that's what we find out in that show. But, you know, I want to invite everyone because we have a premiere party. So if you're listening to Lakeshore Public Radio, I want you to be at our premiere party. It's on the 25th at the Jay Parker. The tickets are free. It's going to be amazing. It's a rooftop view, but you have to register to get them. So they have to go to WhitneyReynolds.com/contact and just put in their info for those tickets.
Whitney, thanks for joining us.
That's Lakeshore Public Radio's Dee Dotson speaking with Whitney Reynolds, who is the host and the executive producer of The Whitney Reynolds Show. The 2019 Valparaiso University Jazz Fest is coming up on April 1st, runs through April 1st and the 5th on campus. It has an array of exciting performances by talented artists, including local performers, as well as Stefan Harris and Blackout and the DeMarco Villarreal Quartet. And I had a chance recently to talk with the creator of the Valparaiso University Jazz Festival, Professor Jeffrey Brown, about it. And here's our conversation. What a history of 34 years for the annual jazz festival at Valparaiso University. And Jeff, take us through the history, what people have listened to over the decades, then come away with a better appreciation of jazz music in general, right?
Oh, for sure. We've had some excellent artists that have crossed the stage, and some of them, unfortunately, are no longer with us. Artists like Slide Hampton, Maynard Ferguson, Frank Foster, Clark Terry, Bobby Shoes, Steve Turay, Bill Watrous. It goes on and on and on. Bobby mm-hmm. Watson, Curtis Fuller, Terrell Stafford. It's some of the biggest names in jazz, and many of them excellent jazz educators as well. We started off as a day-and-a-half festival 34 years ago, and the first guest artist internationally was the second full day of that. It was like a day and a half, mm-hmm. By Friday night and all day Saturday, was Phil Woods, who the legendary alto saxophonist and arranger and composer. And that's what we started with. And it slowly but surely gained momentum. We added the high school component of it about the fifth year in. I saw that most of the jazz ensembles in the high schools, every place that they would go, they'd be adjudicated, and there was no all the festivals and things like that they would go to. So I wanted to do something different for them. I wanted to put the high schools in a professional environment and kind of perform just for the sake of the music and for the joy of playing, and it's worked out great.
I guess it's really more like giving the high school bands and the college bands an opportunity to have some extended jam sessions, right?
Well, there were jam sessions, and there are every year, and they're somewhat not planned. The students get together, and they sometimes it's really cool when students from different high schools get together just on a whim, and while they're in the back, inside rooms, in warm-up rooms, and things like that, there's a common, language and common different forms. Like you'll hear them playing a blues together that they've learned, and mm-hmm. or like something that they've worked with on a play along, like a Jamie Ebersole play along that they all know the same tune, and ironically most of the time in the same key. And so it's a sideline to their performance on stage that they're very prepared for. And a lot of the reason because of that is because this area, and I've seen this firsthand because luckily I've been able to do a lot of traveling throughout the U.S. here, doing clinics and things like that. Northwest Indiana has some of the finer jazz educators, I believe, in the country, and they do an excellent job. And you certainly will witness that on Monday and Tuesday of the festival.
Mm-hmm. And it's, of course, it does start in with the April 1st and April 2nd. That's the opportunities that you have a chance to listen to in the Hari Union Ballroom to these local high school bands get together. And, of course, then on Tuesday of the 2nd, they get a chance to actually perform as well with the Valparaiso University Jazz Ensemble and the Vocal Ensemble. So it gives them an extra treat as well as, I suppose, a little extra education too, right?
Yes. It's two nights of, I figured out just this year we have more bands, I think, than we ever have.
Wow.
We're gonna have over 300 high school students on the stage over April 1st and April 2nd. Washington Township, Kankakee Valley, Morgan Township, Portage High School is bringing two bands. Hobart High School, Chesterton High School, Valparaiso High School is bringing, I believe, three bands. And then there's to close the evening off on Tuesday, April 2nd, the VU Jazz Ensemble will be performing. That's the one that I direct. And there's a brand new ensemble, and which is kind of exciting when there's a new voice in this music. It's great. There's a vocal jazz ensemble that is directed by Professor Anne Marie Bice, and she's doing a great job. And it actually is a jazz combo class that is taught here on campus. But it was so popular, we thought to begin with that it was going to be just about 5 to 6 students. I think that she's got 12 students in there, which enables her to do some vocal jazz arrangements accompanied by the jazz ensemble. So that's something new, and we're looking forward to having that as well.
Now, on Wednesday night, April 3rd, is where we get the college jazz performers busy, and we're talking faculty as well as students with, of course, the Valparaiso University Faculty Jazz Trio and the Jazz Educators Big Band. And there's a new component, I understand, too, which is called the Calumet Ridge Jazz Ensemble. Tell us about that for anybody that's not familiar with that.
Well, it's interesting because the pendulum swings with this. It's interesting, and this pendulum has swung to a really active local big band scene, and the that evening, the VU Faculty Jazz Trio starts off with like about a half an hour set at 6 o'clock, and then the Northwest Indiana Jazz Educator Big Band, which ironically the Faculty Jazz Trio is the rhythm section for, so we just kind of stay on stage, but they come up, and that's directed by myself and Bill Timmerman, who's one of the Portage High School band directors, and it's a fun group. We do this every year, and we get together, we have one rehearsal, and then we have the gig on the third, and it's a lot of fun. A lot of local band directors who've kept their chops up, and we do some interesting music. Then there's the Midwest Big Band and the Calumet Ridge Jazz Ensemble, and they're made up of area musicians who just really love big band music, and they perform at different functions, and they're very good. It's a lot of folks who just primarily do this as their avocation and just love of the music. And I just decided, I said, you know, we just got to give these bands a venue of a place to be recognized. And so another irony is that sometimes I know as a fact there's going to be two or three musicians that that play literally in each one of those bands, but that's how much they enjoy playing. So
wow. That's wonderful. We're talking with Jeff Brown, who is the creator of what is now going to be the 34th annual Valparaiso University Jazz Fest. It's coming up April 1st through the 5th on the Valparaiso University campus. And we get to the high school bands, and you'll get to hear some great performances there. Some regional bands as well with educators and students from the colleges. And now coming up on Thursday, April 4th, the schedule has the professionals, I guess, including some very interesting and well-known professionals, too. Besides yourself, Jeff, and we know you have with the Chicago Jazz Showcase and the Jazz Ensemble, some special guests. Tell us a little bit about Scott Burns, who you had a chance to perform with. In fact, you've actually had to create a CD with.
Yes, Scott's an excellent musician. He teaches up at Loyola and DePaul in Chicago as well. He went to school in the Cincinnati-Dayton area. He's well-known there as well as in Chicago. He's an excellent tenor saxophonist. I think that you're going to play a cut.
Yeah, we have a little clip here from the chance that he had to perform with you folks with the Jazz Ensemble here some time ago. And in fact, it's a composition of your own. Tell us about Nixter, where you came up with that, and where Scott Burns fits into it.
Well, you know, interesting, it is... You have to be careful when you say that it's a composition of mine, because it's a blues.
Uh-huh.
So a blues is a very standard form of tonic sub. No, I'm not in a theory class. A 1-4 and a 5 chord, and with jazz musicians taking liberties in this 12-bar format, and I wrote the melody of it that you hear. The Nixter is a tune written about my youngest son Nicholas, and it's just got a bouncy characteristic to it, and which is somewhat indicative of him.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Nixter with Scott Burns and tenor sax. Now, also, too, on the program on Thursday evening, April 4th, along with Scott Burns performing, Farid Whitted is the trumpeter that is, and his colleague Tom Garling on the trombone. Tell us what they're going to be performing during the that concert on April 4th.
Oh, there's literally some beautiful Thad Jones, Mel Lewis type of arrangements that we're going to be doing. There's a beautiful ballad and a gorgeous arrangement of "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes."
Yeah.
The great Jerome Kern tune that was arranged by Don Braden, actually, when Don Braden was here as a guest artist. A lot of various styles and just great tunes featuring three of Chicago's finest jazz musicians.
Now, Friday, April 5th, the crowd that comes for the 34th Annual Jazz Fest for the performances at the Howrah Union Ballroom on Friday the 5th will be treated by the Jazz Festival Concert, and you have, as the opening act, of the Marco Villarreal Quartet. Tell us what Marco brings to the jazz scene here.
Well, Marco's a brilliant guitarist, and he's a product of Northwest Indiana. I don't know where he lives now. I know he lives locally here. But he plays literally around the United States. He plays with Frank Russell's band in Chicago, and he does a lot of solo acts around here. But he's a really interesting, both straight ahead and fusion-ish type of guitarist, and he'll be doing all of his own original arrangements, and it'll be an exciting way to open that evening up.
And Stefan Harris and Blackout is also going to be on the bill as well on Friday night. People that aren't familiar with Stefan's music and Blackout's music, tell us about that.
Well, Stefan's for the past 3 to 4 years, he's been ranked number one jazz vibraphonist in Downbeat magazine. And he was on the cover of Downbeat magazine about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And he's just a phenomenal. He'll be playing both vibraphone and marimba with this group. The group spans the gamut of repertoire. He'll be doing all original material, but it's very hard to pigeonhole him into a category. He does gorgeous ballads. He does really raucous fusion. He can do some straight ahead stuff. He has some excellent musicians with him. It'll actually be a quintet that will be on stage. And so I would truly, if you want to come out and hear a younger, brilliant musician and educator too, he's going to be doing a master class at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, which is open to the public. And the master class will be, in the Union Ballroom where mm-hmm. the concerts are all, and then I would just strongly encourage you to come out and hear a very unique ensemble.
Well, tickets are available for this 34th annual Valparaiso University Jazz Fest, available at the Howrah Union box office. And you can get them, you also check the website too, vu.edu, for more information. Would you say, Jeff, that for all the years that you've had a chance to shape the Jazz Fest, that these are some of the best years that have come along, even though we don't have some of the big names that have unfortunately passed us over the years, but we have these up-and-coming people that seem to be making jazz and making people's appreciation of jazz, whichever form it may happen to be, more important every year?
True, and I've always said it's interesting if you got 10 people in a room and asked them what jazz was, you would get 10 different answers, from traditional to swing to fusion to funk to every, all of these various subgenres that have helped define jazz over the years. And that's what I've attempted to do with this festival over the years, is to try to be non-categorical. There are traditional jazz festivals. There's like the Bix Beiderbecke thing, and there's all kinds of different types of festivals that they have an isolated, repertoire, for lack of another way of putting it.
Sort of following in the history of like the Newport Jazz Festival and the other ones that have come in the past.
Sure, although Newport's has a very very eclectic lineup as well.
Mm-hmm.
The that's what's best. It's been one of the goals of mine to keep it open for that, because that helps expose an audience to what's new and what's cutting edge, and then indeed at the same time respecting the strong history of this music, because it's truly America's only indigenous musical art form.
Well, Jeff Brown, thank you very much for being with us to talk about this. It's the 2019, the 34th annual Jazz Fest coming up at Valparaiso University, April 1st through the 5th on campus. And we appreciate you spending time and showing your appreciation not only to the public about this great music, but helping keep it alive with all the young people, not only helping those on colleges, but also high schools as well, too, with the seminars and the sessions that you get to do with them. Thanks for spending time with us to talk about it.
Chris, thank you for your support. I appreciate it.
And that, by the way, is Farid Whitted, the jazz trumpeter that Jeff Brown was talking about, one of the performers coming up at the Jazz Festival at Valparaiso University here on the Friday and Saturday night performances. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Hope you join us on Monday. We'll bring you our conversation with Chuck Hughes with the Gary Chamber of Commerce.